This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Today we ask the director of the Michigan Department of Transportation why the roads are such a mess.
We dug ourselves a huge hole and it's going to take a lot to climb out of it.
The deal to overhaul auto no-fault insurance. Some don't like it, some do.
Affordable auto insurance is a critical economic mobility issue, and so we need to make sure that everyone in Michigan has accessibility to affordable rates.
We talked to Stateside's education commentator about changing how teachers deal with so-called troublemakers.
Before, you would say to a kid when they got into trouble and was standing right in front of you, you would say to them, "What did you do?" And now you want to talk to them and say, "What happened?"
Then we talked to the author of the latest fly fishing guide to Michigan.
Michigan's got a very rich and long-standing history with fly fishing.
And we've got a Michigan History Center mystery for you. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Today, supporters of the recent changes to the state's auto insurance laws say lower rates are on the way. But what might that mean for low-income Michiganders?
Auto insurance and affordable auto insurance is a critical economic mobility issue. And so we need to make sure that everyone in Michigan has accessibility to affordable rates.
But first, fixing Michigan's roads was a major theme of Governor Gretchen Whitmer's campaign. She says the state needs to spend $2.5 billion more each year to fix roads and bridges. She wants to increase the gas tax by 45 cents a gallon to raise the money. The new director of the Michigan Department of Transportation has been talking to groups about the need for road maintenance and making the argument for the gas tax increase. So far, people are not enthused about the idea. Here to talk about that is the MDOT director, Paul Ajaba. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Lester. Thanks for having me.
So you've worked for the Michigan Department of Transportation for more than 28 years. How did we get to the point that we need so many repairs, so much money to fix the roads?
Well, Lester, I think this issue has been around for a while. It's no secret that Michigan is ranked 46th out of 50 states in spending per capita on our infrastructure. MDOT has been on record for over a decade now saying this problem is coming. Our roads are deteriorating. And now it's becoming very obvious to everybody that, yes, our roads are really deteriorating. Right now, the main challenge we have is that our roads are rated 78% in fair and good condition. If we don't do anything now, in 2-3 years, it's going to dip down into the 60s. Can you imagine when the public is now saying that 78% is not good enough to dip down into the 60s? I think this is where the issue is becoming more and more urgent that we do something now to stop the slide.
You mentioned the price or the amount we spend per capita on roads. I also did some calculations myself looking at per mile costs, and Ohio and some of the other states in the Great Lakes area spend more per mile than we do. But we've got the highest gas tax in the region. So is the 45-cent gas tax increase the way to go? I mean, that doesn't, you know, 3/4 of the people who were polled by the Senate for Michigan say no to a 45-cent gas tax increase.
Well, again, I think the governor's plan, the beauty of it is that she has said, this is my plan, this is my idea. Anybody has a better idea on how to raise the $2.5 billion to fix the roads? Let's put it on the table and let's have the discussion. We looked at the myriads of options, raising the sales tax, corporate tax, all that stuff does not generate this much money. Again, we did not get here overnight. This is a 40 years of disinvestment in the making. We dug ourselves a huge hole and it's going to take a lot to climb out of it. I tell you, people say Ohio and these other states have been spending a lot more money than we have for a long time. Ohio just did, they just raised their gas tax again to keep ahead of the curve. While, you know, we have not been investing as much in these other states.
Even though the experts have been saying for a while now that we need to spend $2.5 billion more, according to this polling by the Center for Michigan, most believe $1 billion ought to be sufficient, and they also believe that the governor can find that money by just cutting things in the budget. How do you respond to people who don't quite understand the budget in the state?
Well, don't take it from me. Take it from the previous administration's task force that recommended before they left office that we needed $2.2 billion. It's right there in the record. So for people to say, well, we don't need $2.2 billion, we only need $1 billion, we're going to be falling back into the same trap we've been in. In 2015, as you can remember, Lester, the legislature passed a gas tax and a budget that says we're going to fix the road with $1.2 billion. Whereas MDOT was on record as saying that just for our system, we needed $1.2 billion. So they passed a $1.2 billion bill. They ran it through the Act 51 formula. MDOT only got 39% of that $1.2 billion, which means that we are 61% in the hole going in. And quite frankly, the $1.2 billion, only $600 million of it kicked in 2017. The other $600 million, we're still waiting. That doesn't kick in till 2021. So while we're waiting for the other half, the roads are deteriorating. So for people out there that are not experts in this, that have not seen the study and all the internal data that shows that we need this $2.5 billion or more to keep our roads in 90% condition, I think they just not been realistic. I will tell you, the roadways and the bridges are the backbone of our economy. And to me, I believe this is our charge, our generation, to keep for the next generation. So $2.2 billion is not something I've come up with. That's from the last administration. Now it's 2.5. The longer we wait, the more expensive it gets.
There's another concern that people talk about. They're saying the roads are deteriorating because they don't think the Department of Transportation is getting the quality of road work it should for the tax dollars it's spending. What's your response to that concern?
Well, that's another myth. I will tell you that what we have been forced to do in the last 10 or more years is doing bandage projects. When we go out there, we mill a little bit off the top and put it back, maybe 2 inches, and put 2 inches back. It looks good for about 5 years. People think we've solved the problem, we've fixed the road. Whereas all we did is just kind of skim a little bit off the top and resurfacing. There's a difference between resurfacing a road and reconstructing a road. Some of our roadways needs reconstructing. When you resurface a road, all you did is just kick the can down the road for 5 to 7 years. In 5 to 7 years, you're going to start seeing cracks coming back up. You're going to have maintenance crew out there patching, and people get upset. You were just out here. But the difference is that we were out there doing resurfacing, not reconstruction. That's the huge issue.
The response to the Center for Michigan polling also suspect that the money being raised for the roads is being spent on something else. What can you do to better show where you're spending the money?
Well, again, don't take it from me. The last administration's study showed $2.2 billion is needed. And to suggest that we're spending or we are going to be spending the money somewhere else is just not correct.
A recent Free Press report followed you and the governor around as you were looking at aging bridges. They're expensive. How much of a problem does Michigan have with state's bridges?
Oh, well, for MDOT-owned bridges, we are not doing as badly as the local bridges. MDOT has identified about 1,100 to 1,200 bridges statewide that are in really need of, they are in critical condition that needs to be fixed.
These are county and city bridges?
Yes, the county and city bridges. The bridge that we visited, Miller Road, is a bridge that's right next to the Ford truck plant. Can you imagine
the River Ridge plant?
Yeah, exactly. Can you imagine that bridge being down? We went underneath that bridges. There are about 525 temporary supports holding that bridge up. That means the existing support is not strong enough anymore to sustain the load of that bridge. So we have to shore it up with new supports. That is the dilemma, because in 4 or 5 years, we're going to have to do something about that bridge. It's estimated to cost about $50 to $60 million to reconstruct that entire bridge. And that's the issue. That money's got to come from somewhere. So what MDOT has decided to do, these bridges, we're going to bundle them up together, and then we're going to bond for them and put them out for bid, because these are real critical bridges. Quite frankly, as I mentioned, these are the backbones of our economy.
You're going to get bonds for all of that, all those bridge repairs?
For the bridges, yes.
You know, whenever I think about bridges in poor condition, I think about that horrific bridge collapse on I-35 in Minneapolis back in 2007. 13 people died in it. Dozens were injured when that bridge collapsed during rush hour. Could that happen somewhere in Michigan?
Well, as the governor said when we visited that site, these are things that keeps us up at night. Somebody in charge of the Department of Transportation, this is the kind of stuff that keeps me up at night. I pray and hope we don't get to that point before we start solving this road and bridge issue. And we at the department are working hard to make sure that does not happen.
What happens if there's no deal on road improvement during this session and we end up in a kind of wait-and-see situation?
Honestly, Lester, I'm an optimist. I really do have not thought about not having any resolution to this. I really believe, again, as the governor and I go around the state educating people, there's a general consensus out there that we do have a road problem. And I believe both sides are ready to find a solution to this problem.
But the people are saying, we don't want taxes increased. We want you to find this money somewhere else. And they've said, we've already paid more. The previous legislature and previous administration came to us. We gave them more money. They charged us more money as taxpayers. And you were going to fix the roads. Why should we give you more money?
Well, again, that's a decision between the governor and the legislature on how we raise the money. But what the governor has said is, this is my plan. If anybody has a better idea on how to raise that much money to fix the problem, she's willing to have that conversation.
Paul Ajaba is the director of the Michigan Department of Transportation. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you so much, Leslie, for having me.
There are nearly 7 million fly fishers in the U.S., according to a 2018 survey. Michigan fly fishing enthusiast and author John Osborne is one of them. He's just released a new version of the Fly Fisher's Guide to Michigan, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Lester.
There obviously was a lot of effort to put this guide together. It's a large book, a lot of tips, data, stories about Michigan's fly fishing. How did you become so interested in fly fishing?
Yeah, that's a loaded question, right? I mean, I started out as a young child with my dad and fishing bait and then fishing lures and gradually progressed into fly fishing. And I can really go back to a guy that I went to the police academy with who just introduced it to me and kind of just instilled that passion for fly fishing. And ever since, I've just been going all the time as much as I can.
Help us understand, because you talked about passion. I'm trying to figure out, why are some people so passionate about fly fishing?
You know, fly fishing, it requires an active versus a passive approach. So when you go bait fishing and you put a worm on a hook and throw a bobber out there, you're kind of waiting for something to happen versus fly fishing. Not that there's anything better about it, but you need an active approach. So you need to become a student of the water that you're on, learn the hatches, learn what the fish are eating, if they're eating sculpins or if they're eating mice or if they're eating insects, and learn about those and then tie on your best guess and hope for the best. But I think it's different than just sitting there and waiting for something to happen.
Yeah, you talked about making sure you understood what's happening on the river, the different conditions of the river that's essential to fly fishing. So explain that a little bit for us, would you?
Yeah, so for example, right now we're kind of at the tail end of Hendrickson mayflies. We're going to be working into sulfur mayflies here. And if you're not prepared for that kind of event and you think that you're going to be fishing for something else, if you go out there with hex flies, for example, that's another mayfly that's going to be hatching later, more toward late June, early July, you're just not going to have the best of luck. So you need to read up on that. You need to make sure that you know the size of the flies that you're tying on. And then, you know, what stage the insect is in. Is it in a nymphal stage, or is it emerging, or is it spinning, which is when they're actually laying eggs and dying on the water. And the fish are going to key in on different aspects of that. And a lot of times they're going to just turn their noses up at any other method.
Right. I get the feeling you have to kind of think like a fish too.
Yeah, as much as you can. Right.
How does fly fishing in Michigan compare to other states?
Boy, Michigan's got a very rich and longstanding history with fly fishing. There's no doubt. And there's other states that do as well, but Michigan's kind of top of the pile on that whole thing. For example, you were asking, you know, how it differs, but say Montana's going to have more larger average size fish. So if you go out to Montana, you're going to be catching, you know, 14, 15, 16 inch fish all day long. Michigan, you'd be very, very fortunate to do that during the day. That's kind of a banner day when you're catching fish like that. But Michigan also has an incredible nighttime fishery. It's just a different way to fish. You know, you're fishing close to the wood. Some guides call it tickling the wood. You're fishing different aspects of the river, whereas like when I fished in Montana during the daytime, depending on the river that you're on, you may be indicator nymphing. So you're fishing a nymph, a stage of the insect, underneath a float, which is basically just a bobber. And that's completely different than drifting a grasshopper as close as you can to a log jam and hoping some brown trout's going to come out from underneath that log jam and smack the grasshopper imitation that you're working.
Now, you're talking about a lot of flies, and I know that's critical to fly fishing. I interviewed a guy for our Artisans of Michigan series who ties flies for a living. His name's Dennis Potter. I was amazed at the variety of flies. You wrote this book about flies fly fishers used before. And in this book, in the Fly Fisher's Guide to Michigan, you included some popular Michigan flies in it. So why so many flies? Because you're having a, you know, you talked about the different mayflies coming in. Are we talking about all those insects and more?
Yeah, so you know, when we say fly fishing, a lot of times people get the idea that it is only flies, but it's not flies like winged insects that we're talking about. There is that aspect of it, but, you know, going back to more of the meaty offerings like crayfish and baitfish and things like that, mice even, you know, frogs. So flies is just a general description that covers all of those lures, for lack of a better word, that you can use to fool fish. And there are so many different flies and so many different popular flies that got their start in Michigan. The Adams, for example, started in 1922. People still fish that thing all the time, and not just in Michigan, but nationally and internationally as well. It's just been a very effective, very popular fly for nearly 100 years now.
We're talking to John Osborne about the new Fly Fisher's Guide to Michigan. The book is just out. So Hemingway has written about fly fishing in Michigan. Presidents have come here to go after coaster brook trouts. Tell me about the history of fly fishing in Michigan.
Yeah, so you hit on Hemingway, which is, he's a biggie, of course. You got Jim Harrison, who's also a very large personality in fly fishing writing. But you also have people like Robert Traver and Jerry Dennis. And then you have artists like Derek DeYoung. His artwork is everywhere. I mean, it's very recognizable. But you also have fly rod makers, and then you also have the Osaba longboat that got its start in Michigan in the late 1800s. And it was built for the logging era to transport tools and supplies up and down the river. But that boat is still in use today. 100 years later, it's still in use, and more than 100 years. It's remained relatively unchanged ever since it got started, and it's just kind of the perfect transportation medium for a river like the Osable.
Right. I understand it's got a really shallow depth. You can go in just a few inches of water.
Yeah, and that's due to the length and the width. I mean, it looks like a long canoe, but it's 23 to 24 feet long. It's only 2.5 feet wide, but very shallow draft, and a guide can stand in there and pull you along in a several inches of water and not scrape bottom.
As I was flipping through the description of Michigan rivers, I couldn't help but remember that a lot of these rivers are polluted with legacy pollutants such as PCBs, dioxin, even DDT, and as we've learned more recently in rivers such as the Rogue River, the Huron River, the tail end of the Ausable, there's PFAS pollution, and this stuff gets into the fish. As someone who enjoys fly fishing around the state, what do you think of these pollution problems?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in short, rivers need friends. And when rivers have advocates and rivers have friends, then those are people that are willing to work to clean up those rivers, because we've done an amazing job of messing them up over the years. And that comes and goes, but you hit on a lot of key points pollution-wise. But it's not something that we can't come back from. Fortunately, rivers are fluid medium. They're always moving. And, you know, if we get to the source of the pollution and deal with that, and then deal with, you know, underlying sediment and things like that where pollutants are lying on the bottom, usually those can come back. But you have all these groups, you know, starting from Trout Unlimited back in 1959, which got its start on the banks of the Ausable River in Michigan, to now you have groups like Anglers of the Ausable, Friends of the Boyne River, Friends of the Pigeon River. The list goes on and on and on. Those rivers need people advocating for them, lobbying for them, organizing cleanup efforts. Another one is Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, which is a relatively new group, but it's a very exciting group in that it's a very fast-growing organization. They've organized a lot of cleanup projects. Recently, they had one on Portage Creek. They have one on the Rifle River coming up. And they also do Pint Nights and podcasts, but they've done an amazing job with that and an amazing job recruiting sportsmen into the sport.
All right, let's hear your 30-second pitch, your most persuasive argument as why someone should try fly fishing if they haven't yet.
Boy. Yeah, so if you haven't tried fly fishing, you need to be okay with the fact that it may be a little bit more difficult than other styles of fishing, but the results are extremely satisfying. And patience is a virtue in life, but also in fly fishing. And you have to be able to deal with tangles and getting caught up in trees and getting fish that snub your offering and things like that. But it took me over a year to catch my first trout. When I finally did, I was extremely satisfied, came back just super happy, because it was such a journey to get to that point, to start from the casting and, you know, tying the right knots and finally presenting a fly to the fish where the fish was willing to take it. So I think that you owe it to yourself to give it a try and realize that it may be a little bit difficult, but that you're going to be real happy once it all comes together.
Yeah, you make the point that a great day fly fishing has nothing to do with how many fish you catch. What do you mean by that?
Well, in short, quality over quantity. You know, fish draw us to the rivers and the streams and the lakes, but they really are a relatively small portion of the overall experience. If we take into consideration the wildlife that we see and the birds that we hear and the conversations, deep, meaningful conversations that we have with fellow anglers on the bank, in the end, we realize that fishing brought us there, but the result is not necessarily related to fishing at all. It's interesting because you have people ask you when they find out that you went fishing, they ask you, you know, how did it go? Or, you know, did you catch any fish? How many did you catch? And if you say, oh, you know, I didn't catch a ton of fish, or maybe a couple small ones, and then they kind of walk away muttering and saying, oh, whatever you say. I mean, that doesn't sound like a good time to me, but it's a great time. You just need to be open to the fact that there's a lot more going on in fly fishing than just the fish.
I had to laugh. I was reading some of the reviews on Amazon's site about your book. One person wrote, quote, "If you don't buy it, that's your loss. More fish for me." I guess you have fans out there.
it's great to hear that kind of thing. I haven't read that one, but no, that's great. It's that's the kind of person that I wrote the book for sure.
John Ausable is the author of The Fly Fisher's Guide to Michigan. Hey, thanks for telling us about it.
Certainly. Thank you, Lester.
It's Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk state history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. Memorial Day weekend is the start to the summer vacation season, right? But Memorial Day began as Decoration Day to commemorate veterans just after the Civil War. Here now to talk about a Civil War veterans memorial mystery is State Archivist with Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. Hi there.
How are you?
So before we start talking about that mystery, how long have we celebrated Memorial Day? When did it become a federal holiday?
Well, it didn't become a federal holiday till the early 1970s. It was first celebrated as Decoration Day in 1868. And then there were some arguments, you know, who celebrated it first before 1868. And I don't know that that argument's ever really been settled, but I think New York State has been credited with the first celebrations post-Civil War.
I'm going to credit my home state, General Logan, for actually making Decoration Day happen across the nation. I suppose he gets most of the credit, right?
Yeah, he gets most of the credit. But there, again, I think since people have gone on and credited General Logan with forming the formal holiday, then people started arguing about whether they had celebrated it before that, which happens.
So let's get to the mystery. First of all, who is Manly McNitt?
Well, Manly McNitt, as far as Civil War veterans go, was not an uncommon individual. He enlisted in the 19th Michigan Infantry, which mustered in Dowagiac September 5th in 1862. So he was just like a lot of people at that time. They were trying to do their bit and enlisted as a private and then went off to war with the 19th Michigan, and they were assigned to the Army of the Cumberland. So not the far east half of the United States, but what we'd call the Middle West now.
So this is not really about his service in the Union Army and the Michigan 19th Infantry. It's about after his life. But tell us about his service.
He enlisted when he was 20 and was in a lot of significant engagements, got wounded, and was put in Libby prison, and then wound up exiting the war in June of 65 after Appomattox.
So the mystery is actually about his memorial marker, his gravestone. What happened to it?
He wound up in La Porte, Texas after the war eventually, and he passed in 1915. And so they honored him with a military marker, which had his rank and name and unit and company that he was in and his birth and death date. But then Hurricane Harvey hit. And La Porte is just southeast of Houston, Texas. So it's really right near the coast of where Hurricane Harvey came ashore. And it just obviously devastated that area and swept his grave marker to the northwest quite a ways, all the way into the Houston proper.
Yeah, the idea of that much force lifting a gravestone and sweeping it down the river or down the streams is pretty impressive. So it turns out that a Texas resident and an Air Force veteran, a guy named Kevin Lewis, finds the gravestone washed up near his home, and he's concerned about getting it back to where it belongs. What happens next?
Well, so he goes to the local authorities, and because it just has that information I described on the marker and nothing else, they're at a loss as to how to help him. But Kevin's intrepid, and he's a veteran, and he wants to honor Manly McNitt and get this grave marker back to its rightful spot. And so he starts making phone calls, and seeing that it's the 19th Michigan Infantry, he does some online searching and finds that the Michigan History Center, specifically the Archives of Michigan, has records of that unit. And so we get a phone call from Mr. Lewis.
Yeah, I assume that's not the typical kind of request. So how'd you guys handle that?
Well, it is pretty typical that people are trying to find information to reset a headstone. But what was not typical is that they're trying to reset a headstone that had been swept away in a hurricane. That was unusual. So there are a lot of good records that organizations like the Sons of the Union Veterans of the Civil War have compiled to make a seemingly esoteric question pretty easy to answer.
Yeah, where was this guy buried? Did you find out what graveyard he was supposed to be in?
Yeah, so we were able to track him down to the Cedarhurst Cemetery in La Porte, but there was also some confusion as to exactly where in the cemetery that stone went, because obviously the whole cemetery was devastated, and they didn't have records down to a grid pattern that showed where those stones went. So we felt pretty good that it wasn't the public cemetery in La Porte, it was this private cemetery called Cedarhurst, but we also felt we'd only got him 9/10 of the way there. And so we gave him the information we had, And then we wrote an article about it in our biannual publication for the archives, send it out to our normal constituents who are exclusively in Michigan. And then a funny thing happened. Somebody posted it on social media, and the great-great-granddaughter of Manley McNitt realized that we had only gotten 9/10 of the way there. And she contacted us and said, I have the rest of the story. And we were able to sync her up with the LaPorte authorities and Kevin Lewis, and they were able to determine the exact location and even set a date where family members traveled back down to LaPorte to have the stone reinstalled.
How's that make you feel when you guys get to help a family like that?
It's really rewarding. I started at the archives in Reference, and there's nothing more rewarding than helping someone find an answer to a question. It doesn't matter if it's something that makes it in the news or if it's just trying to help them figure out, you know, a connection to a relative. For me, it's one of the most enticing things about archival work is just connecting people with information that they're looking for.
Well, a Civil War memorial mystery solved thanks to the Michigan History Center and the State Archives. Thanks very much to State Archivist Mark Harvey for telling the story.
Great. Thank you.
Still to come, we talk about auto no-fault insurance reform. That's in less than 10 minutes. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. Principals and teachers are rethinking how they deal with so-called troublemakers in school. There's been a realization that these students have lives that might be incredibly stressful because of things like homelessness, poverty, and violence. That's resulted in a term, trauma-informed teaching. Joining me is Stateside education commentator and National Hall of Fame teacher Matinga Ragatz. Hi there.
Hello, how are you?
What is trauma-informed teaching?
You covered it really well in your intro. And basically, it's just a learning setting in which we acknowledge the impact of this harmful experiences that students have in their lives. So we call it adverse childhood experiences. And so what we do is we try to create these environments in the schools that support the students, you know, not just physically, but also give them like behavioral and mental services. And by the way, it's not just students who experience trauma in the schools. We are also seeing students who experience trauma that they see on television, just like adults may be freaked out about going on a plane because they see a plane crash on TV. Some of the school shootings and some of the things that are happening in the schools, they're also traumatizing the kids. So teachers have to have a completely new set of radars.
So what does that look like in the school? What does a teacher or a principal do differently?
Well, you know, the term trauma-informed teaching, it's a big umbrella. And so there are different ways that even the Michigan Department of Education and each of the schools are basically practicing this. There are many, many terms that fall under this umbrella, which is like the social curriculum, restorative justice and practices, which is something that the state of Michigan, the Department of Education is encouraging schools to practice, and like whole child teaching, wellness practices. And the whole idea is just to really, really understand where the child is coming from. You know, before you would say to a kid when they got into trouble and it was standing right in front of you, you would say to them, what did you do? And now you want to talk to him and say, what happened? Just so that you can hear his story rather than just interpret his actions.
So what happens to traditional disciplinary actions when the school's trying to introduce trauma-informed teaching?
Well, Lester, this is controversial because some people find it really wooey and kumbaya to not punish in a traditional way. For example, some schools have opted not to suspend students and instead do something like a restorative justice, which is a case where the kids get to tell their story and the teachers get to understand everybody's point of view and then turn that into a learning experience rather than just simply react. And so in some environments, that is considered controversial, but in some environments, that is considered incredibly essential.
Are we asking educators to be social workers?
Yes, we are. But it's not like the job has changed. The world has changed out there. So it used to be a time where we just believed that these kids were bad apples. There's something wrong with the child. Now we understand that this behavior it's a product of their biography. So we focus on what exactly is causing that behavior, and then we try to fix it. We will brainstorm and come with innovative ways of fixing that. So as a society, I think we need to decide whether we want these like well-adjusted and functional children, or we want to continue to push this Sputnik era math and science obsessions. So the problem here is that teachers are meant to be social workers as well as extreme academics, and so there's not enough time to do all of that.
Are new teachers and teachers who are working getting the training they need to make this adjustment?
You know, the universities are doing their very, very best. But one of the things I believe that the new teachers are lacking is just the experience of seeing what really is happening with these kids and how they are traumatized. So we might learn about it in the classroom from a documentary or maybe even from a special speaker, but it's completely different when you're in the classroom and you're seeing a real meltdown, a real mental illness meltdown. It's very, very different. And so I feel like they lack that experience and that reality in their practice.
Matinga Gregatz is a National Hall of Fame teacher and Stateside's education commentator. Nice to talk to you again. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Lester.
Some Democratic lawmakers and some victim of car crashes are not very happy with Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Whitmer reached a deal with Republican legislators to change Michigan's auto insurance laws, which would, among other things, eliminate mandatory unlimited medical coverage for severely injured car crash victims. Instead, the overhaul would offer a tiered system of coverage, giving car owners a choice in how much medical coverage to buy. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick was at an event with opponents of the deal. What are those legislators and car crash victims saying?
Well, they had some pretty strong words for Governor Whitmer. They felt that this was, on a couple of particular levels, kind of a betrayal. They felt that this was a fundamental attack on the system that has guaranteed coverage for so many people who have been our car accident survivors and have suffered serious injuries as a result. This is what State Representative Isaac Robinson from Detroit had to say.
She has to be held accountable for these broken promises.
Yeah.
This breaks the promise to end redlining. This breaks the promise to protect our health care.
So in terms of what he was talking about there, in terms of redlining, this legislation does explicitly ban the use of some what are called non-driving factors that are used to determine insurance rates, for example, things like credit scores, and bans the use of zip codes. But these Democrats say that there are a lot of loopholes in this bill that will allow insurers essentially allow them to continue doing just what they're doing, just sort of in a more covert way.
But overall, this is supposed to lower auto insurance premiums, stop the auto insurance industry from using discriminatory non-driving factors to set rates, things like zip codes, gender, credit scores, and so on. So why are the state representatives from Detroit, where insurance rates are sky high, highest in the nation, why would they be opposed at all?
Well, a couple reasons. The first is, as I mentioned, that they say that despite the explicit language in this bill that bans the use of things like, as you said, credit scores and gender and zip codes, it doesn't necessarily ban, for example, what's called territorial rating. So if insurers can't necessarily use your zip code, but they can use geographic areas to set rates, and their contention is that they're going to continue doing just that. It may reduce disparities between zip codes somewhat, but overall, people who live in certain areas are probably still going to get hit with higher rates.
That sounds like a pretty big loophole there.
Yeah, and also the use of credit scores, but it doesn't ban the use of, for example, credit history or what's called an insurance score, which is sort of a different version of the same thing. So there's that. And then there's also the fact that they say that these mandated rate reductions are only going to go toward the personal injury protection portion of an insurance premium. And that doesn't take into account all the other factors. The personal injury protection is about half of what makes up your premium, but there's other factors as well. So they're saying this is essentially they're giving up a lot and, for a lot of folks may not see much of, if any, rate reductions.
These Democrats are ticked off at Governor Whitmer. 19 Democrats voted against this deal, and they say they're going to hold Whitmer responsible, as you mentioned earlier. But how much power do they really have to do that?
I don't know that they have much at this point. I mean, even several members of their own caucus defected and I guess you could say and voted with the majority of the Republicans to support these bills. And, you know, they're certainly trying to exercise some leverage over Governor Whitmer, hinting at least that they're going to be less inclined to work with her on future legislation. But in terms of this bill, it seems that the governor has her mind made up that this is a good bipartisan compromise. And at this point, their political options are pretty limited. Now, there was talk about possibly starting a voter referendum, but that was when things were different last week. And I don't know if that's still really in the cards.
Michigan radio reporter Sarah Swick covers Detroit for us. Thanks very much for talking with us, Sarah.
Thanks a lot, Lester.
A recent study by the University of Michigan found auto insurance rates are unaffordable for residents in 97% of Michigan counties. Patrick Cooney led that study. He's an assistant director of Poverty Solutions Detroit Partnership on Economic Mobility out of the U of M. He joins us now to talk about why lower rates are good for residents, especially in Detroit. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
We've all heard again and again that Detroit's auto rates were the highest in the nation. But what does that really mean as far as comparing to their income?
Right. So our analysis showed that with the average Detroiter's auto insurance rates of $5,400 a year, which is double the rate for the average Michigan driver, which in turn is double the rate of the average U.S. driver, that ended up making up 18% of Detroiters' median income, which is an incredible cost burden. By way of example, for getting housing subsidies, the way that we measure cost burden is whether your rent is 30% mm-hmm. of your median income. And that's rent, and we're talking about 18% for auto insurance. And so something sort of had to give to make sure that Detroiters had a shot at legal car ownership in their pursuit of economic mobility.
As we heard earlier, not everyone's thrilled with the no-fault auto insurance overhaul. A prominent attorney, Stephen Gersten, with Michigan Auto Law Firm, says the sad reality is that the deal Governor Whitmer and Republican legislators are touting falls far short of what's being promised. Gersten goes on to say the rate reductions are not going to offer an appreciable difference to lower premiums. And he concludes, everyone loses because politicians have rushed to cobble together a short-term deal that fails to solve the problem. So what do you think of Gersten's assessment?
Right. So I understand the temptation to want to make sure, obviously, that everyone is covered. We had the most generous auto insurance benefits in the country by far. And so taking those away, I understand there could be some hesitancy. Our argument here, though, is that the system was built on exorbitant and exclusionary rates. An estimated 60% of Detroit drivers didn't have any insurance at all. So there was a significant portion of the population that was not covered at all. We think that the moves made by the legislature and the governor is going to help lower rates for the majority of Michigan citizens. It's going to retain coverage for those that need it. And we think that auto insurance and affordable auto insurance is a critical economic mobility issue. And so we need to make sure that everyone in Michigan has accessibility to affordable rates.
In fact, you'd offer a poverty solution. It offered some recommendations. Some of them were incorporated in this. Why don't you go down the list of things you like about it?
Yeah. So in our analysis, we basically came to the conclusion that you needed to address three different areas in order to reduce rates and retain some quality coverage. The first was doing away with unlimited lifetime personal injury protection. We're the only no-fault state in the country that had that, and it really drove up rates. The second piece is introducing medical fee schedules. So in private insurance, in Medicare, workers' compensation, all those are on medical fee schedules where you can negotiate rates with medical providers.
So there are limits to the cost.
There's limits, exactly.
And some consistency.
That's right, yeah. And with auto insurance, you could be paying kind of beyond top dollar, sort of multiple times what those rates would be. And the last one is making sure that we have some regulation on insurers on not incorporating a lot of these non-driving factors into making the rates. And so all these factors were included in one way or another in the bill, and so we think it's a great step forward.
Well, let's start with the first one. Critics say dropping the mandatory unlimited personal injury protection is going to mean that people who are cash-strapped are not going to buy that protection. It'll still be available, but they'll buy a lesser amount of insurance. If they're severely injured in a car crash, they quickly run out of insurance coverage then. They end up probably bankrupting their families. They end up on Medicaid, and then we all end up paying for the bills and not get the same level of treatment for the crash victim. So how's that helping low-income residents?
Right. So a couple things here. I think the first thing is, again, going back to the argument that there were thousands of Michigan drivers who were not protected under the previous auto insurance just because it was too expensive. It was exclusionary. So I think that's the first point. The second point is, like you said, there are multiple options for coverage, retaining the current rate. So in the bill, if you kept it at $250,000 of personal injury protection, which is above and beyond what's required in most states, you're still going to get some rate reduction. And then I think to the point about the sort of lowest rate of personal injury protection, if you were to get $50,000 of personal injury protection, the vast majority of accidents, auto injury accidents in Michigan, would be covered under that $50,000, particularly when we introduce medical fee schedules, which was a huge cost driver. And I think the last point here is that we have to kind of do away with the false choice that the only way that we can make sure that people are covered is through this system that had exorbitant and exclusionary rates, rather than thinking through how do we make sure that people are covered under catastrophic accidents, whether it's in a car or otherwise, and making sure that we have a healthcare system that provides for that.
Almost everyone, with the notable exception of medical providers, felt the fee limits for medical care were important in the no-fault auto insurance overhaul. But the medical community warns the cost of that care still must be paid, and it will result in higher rates, whether it's health insurance or some other way for others. What's your response to that concern?
You know, we've heard some of the same concerns, and I think that we can't put all of the eggs in the basket of auto insurance. We had this very unique system of auto insurance that you don't see in any other state in the country, and we were basically balancing the books based on this. And I think we have to move away from that because, again, it was preventing a lot of Michigan drivers, low-income Michigan drivers, from driving or from driving legally, which was setting them back in their pursuit of economic mobility.
Do you think our health insurance rates are going to go up because we don't have that auto insurance health coverage?
You know, I don't know, but it's something that we're going to have to keep an eye on going forward. But I think that making this shift away from balancing the books based on this unique system of auto insurance was a step that needed to be taken.
The insurance industry has long argued the use of details such as gender, marital status, zip codes, credit scores, home ownership, and on are all indicators of how much risk to assign to a driver. By barring the use of those details, how do you think the auto insurers will now determine rates for us?
Yeah, so this is probably the part of the bill that we're most excited about. The use of non-driving factors we felt was discriminatory and would drive up rates for low-income drivers, irregardless of what their driving record was. So I think that auto insurers should be able to make determinations on rates based on driving factors. So the best model here, which we cited in our study, was California. They make sure that all insurers are making their pricing models based on three dominant factors, all related to your driving record, number of miles driven, things like this. And that has to weigh more than half of the factors that are brought in. And I think that's a great model to look to. Michigan is now the fourth state in the country that has banned the use of credit scores in determining rates. And we think that's a huge step forward, us in Michigan becoming a leader on making sure that we're not bringing in these non-driving factors that are discriminatory in driving up rates for low-income people.
How long do you expect these lower rates to stick around before rates start rising again?
So this is our biggest thing. We're approaching this bill. We think it's a step in the right forward, but it's kind of making sure that we're checking every step along the way. We think the next step here is making sure that we have more data, that the insurance companies and regulators are more transparent with the data, and that we're following this every year to make sure that we can keep a track on making sure these rates do not go up and ensure that Michigan drivers and low-income Michigan drivers are paying affordable rates that are in line with the rest of the country.
Patrick Cooney is with the University of Michigan's Poverty Solutions Detroit Partnership on Economic Mobility. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Join us tomorrow when we'll look at the history of Native American fishing and hunting rights in Michigan. Plus, we'll talk with Governor Whitmer from the Mackinac Policy Conference. That and more on tomorrow's Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty, thanks for listening.